we need to censor things, we need to control what's taught in school, we need to control what books people read. It's because of this low faith in the average human mind. And again, maybe that's self-fulfilling, but it's been a story that the left has told, or the authoritarians, the scientific managers have told for a long, long time in this country. So now this more responsible looking version is this. It's like, look, the game has just changed too much on the other side. You know, it's not that you're too dumb. I mean, here you are, after all, reading the New York Times.
Right.
But you don't have the capabilities. You don't know what you're up against, which is a less talking down to kind of treatment of it than what they've done before.
Let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
You've said earlier that the left has treated people like they're too dumb.
Right.
Like, through all the schooling, and you've given a number of examples. Roll back the tape if you'd like, listener. They're winning. They have won.
Everything. Yep, yep.
Everything. There are no libertarian or right-leaning institutions of any size or scope that exist. None. We hold nothing. They have won. Is it possible, Brett, that they are right?
This is Brett. Today is Thursday, July 22nd, 2021. You know, about 9 years ago, when we were doing our show on the radio, somebody sent me a show prep, this curious article. I don't remember where it was from or exactly what it was called, but it was something like Texas Republicans seek to ban critical thinking from schools. And I thought to myself, that sounds too good to be true for my purposes. So, not to, contradict the advice of this article that I'm going to be analyzing on the show today with my friend Scott Hambrick, I decided back then to go down a bit of a rabbit hole. What does this mean? Texas Republicans want to ban critical thinking from schools? Well, this rabbit hole led to a really, really important discovery. What was being called critical thinking in schools was actually a euphemism for something called outcomes-based education, a more subtle an arguably insidious form of indoctrination, originally formulated in higher ed in the 1960s. This is a story I've told many times on the show since this discovery. It's also in John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, about how to transform attitudes and values of students without them or their parents really noticing. And if the values transformation couldn't happen on the first run through, well, you just put them through a process of remediation until they hold the proper thoughts. So I'm glad I went down that rabbit hole. It was a really, really important discovery that bolstered our school as indoctrination collection of content. And a lot of this was going on right where I sit today in Allegheny County. The woman who was kind of spearheading that investigation, her name was Peg Luxick. And her video, Who Controls Our Children?, has to this point slipped through the cracks and is still available on YouTube. If you've never heard of Peg Luxick or this video or outcomes-based education, I would add that to your viewing queue. So, months ago, another story came across my desk. It is from the New York Times and kind of framed as an opinion piece. It's called Don't Go Down the Rabbit Hole. Critical thinking as we're taught to do it isn't helping in the fight against misinformation. So on this encounter, I'm looking it over and saying, is this too good to be true again? And you're about to find out. So Scott and I have been looking for some inspiration to collaborate. And we recently thought we found a topic that we could pursue together on the show. But a lot of what we were finding really just didn't translate to a compelling audio podcast presentation. So I said, I've been sitting on this story for a while, this timely gem from the New York Times opinion dissemination section came out back in February. We'll talk about that today as well. So I thought Scott and I would sit down for one of our lovely morning shows over some coffee and just have a casual chat about it. We wound up talking about this for 3 hours. So I'm going to split it into two parts, and I've decided to cliffhang it at a bit of a compelling spot. And I'm going to pick up where Scott and I left off at a show that I'm going to put in between these two parts with Daryl Becker and Tony Myers, the continuation of our This Is a Test series, now in this revisitation called This Is Not About a Virus. And we're going to be testing out some of the author's recommendations in the early goings of that show that will be coming next week. Please remember, we are a listener-supported show. There are numerous ways for you to do that. Patreon.com/schoolsucks, schoolsucksproject.locals.com. And if you join us on Locals, you can access playlists to all our serial bonus shows, The Discomfort Zone, Picture of the Month Club, and In Pursuit of Utopia. If you're interested in the University private community that gets mentioned several times during this discussion, there is a link in the show notes to join on a monthly basis. And there is also a link if you want to learn more about the upcoming Mindset and Mastery Virtual Summit that I'm hosting with Nathan Frazier at the very end of August. Please remember, this show, like over 1,000 hours of School Sucks content, is free for you to listen to, but is not free for me to plan, produce, post-produce, and promote. But thank you for listening, because I know your time and attention, like mine, are a scarce resource. Daryl and Tony are coming up at the beginning of next week. That is a monster show as well. I'm very, very proud of the conversation that the three of us had. Then part two with Scott. Then a conversation with Joe Motard and Shane Radliff on intentional communities. So there's a lot in the queue. I have some University weekly discussion group calls that I'll be putting out to supporting listeners as well. There's a new episode of The Discomfort Zone with me, Andrew, Drew Sample, and Alex Bell on various topics in financial self-defense. If you're a supporting listener, check that out too. Also remember that I'll be at the Midwest Peace and Liberty Fest. I will be there August 12th through the 15th. The entire event runs to the 16th. The 16th is kind of the coolest day, if you ask me. The website is mplfest.org. So let's get into it. Here's my conversation with Scott Hambrick responding to Don't Go Down the Rabbit Hole, this New York Times warning about the dangers of critical thinking. We're going to start this conversation already in progress. I cut the very beginning out because Scott and I are talking about some things that I'm not totally ready to talk about here yet. You get the idea. Here is my conversation with Scott Hambrick, already rolling. And I mean, we're really rolling. Here we go. But I'm ready to keep podcasting if the world will allow it.
Well, there you go. Yeah, I'm in the process of getting canceled right now.
You think so?
Yeah, probably. I mentioned the concept of the marital debt on a podcast the other day, and I've been roundly attacked. You know about the marital debt?
No.
Well, it goes a little something like this. This is a Catholic idea. So you go and you get married and you make a vow to meet the other's marital needs, you see. Mm-hmm. And you can't commit adultery because you've taken this vow.
Yes.
So the spouse, it is incumbent on the spouses to always give consent to intimacy. Because we've already promised to be the only supply of intimacy.
Yes.
So the spouses are exhorted to not withhold consent and intimacy. Well, so we don't want the other one committing adultery. We don't want to be the cause of that. And it could potentially be the cause of that. And you don't want someone to be able to withhold intimacy and to be able to use that as a weapon in the marriage.
Of course.
So there they have that concept. Well, everybody's like, oh, Hambrick's for marital rape. I'm like, you guys are so stupid. Like, and this actually goes to this article.
Yes.
A little bit. Like, how does telling someone that you should not withhold intimacy or consent, whatever. I mean, they've got this word consent's poisoned now. But how is it that you say, saying to someone, hey, you really shouldn't withhold intimacy from your spouse. How's that tantamount to a sanctioning rape? Well, it's not.
It's missing such an enormous conversation about romantic relationships and marriage, too. Like, shouldn't a question that gets inserted in there be like, how do you remain desirable to your spouse?
Mm.
Right?
Well, that's not hard for me or you. I mean, look at us.
Right. But
that's not something I think about very much.
Instead of talking about it as like this debt, right, there's some personal responsibility to take there and some, you know, like conscious living and doing inside this most important relationship and not feeling like you're owed something. And I mean, this goes both ways, both sexes, right? Not feeling like you're owed something or you're entitled to withhold something that there's like an open line of communication about that. And the pledge is about maintaining excitement and desirability.
Yeah.
Right. So if that gets missed in that conversation, I mean, what a crappy way, like what you're accused of there. What a crappy way of not dealing with any of the investigations that kind of underlie that question. Right.
Of course.
Right.
You know, and it's always guys, too. It's all dudes attacking. It's all dudes, these white knights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's no thought given. It's like, okay, let's say a spouse doesn't ever need to consent or ever need to be willing to have intimacy with the other spouse.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
That no consent is ever needed once the marriage happens as one kind of extreme.
Right.
No, of course not.
Of course not. And so they would say, oh, well, that of course not. Okay, well, then at some point, like if that person never wants to consent, you would say at some point that they need to just lay there and let stuff happen.
Right.
And they would probably say something like, yeah, oh, like, okay, so a little of what I'm saying is okay, but not a lot of what I'm saying, you know, like it their arguments don't hold an extreme. They don't think about it at all. But one of the words that they've been taught to be triggered on, consent, was in the discussion.
Yes.
And critical thinking, as we are taught to do it, isn't helping in the fight against misinformation. You know, this article that we're getting ready to discuss, Don't Go Down the Rabbit Hole, the title of the article. I think that the ideas in this article are what is leading these people to hear like one of these trigger words. And it's not triggering in that snowflake 2015 sort of way. It triggers them to go into their cult programming and they can't hear anything else after it.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that this article we're getting ready to talk about is more of the cult programming. It's telling them to not go any farther. Like when you see certain sources and you see certain ideas, to back away.
Yeah.
Stay with the narrative. When you see certain keywords or you see certain sources, back out, back away.
Right. So there's a couple of interesting lead-ins. You guys on Online Great Books, that's your podcast, Online Great Books, for the last 2 weeks, you and Carl have been covering unrestricted warfare. I think that could factor into our conversation in some interesting ways today. You know, there was a pretty black-pilled moment in that show. I was listening back to it recently, and you're talking about, you know, all of these avenues of attack that now exist. And this is really like now, meaning the 21st century, avenues of attack where, you know, warfare is not left to the soldier anymore. We've seen the emergence of all kinds of new warriors, even if people don't know they are participating in a war in the 21st century. But Carl says something like, well, if you knew you were being poisoned, you could at least not take the poison. And the black-pilled moment, your response was, what if the poison is everything?
Yeah.
We're seeing more and more of that in the last 18 months. The information war is not new, but it has certainly accelerated in that time. And, you know, I'll let you comment on that in a sec. But another thing this relates to, originally our topic was going to be something called the Delphi technique, which was basically a series of tactics for achieving a kind of perceived public consensus on a policy issue, like how people could be manipulated through, you know, being sent down a certain path to think that they arrived at the smartest conclusion about, you know, some policy that their local government or their state government should pursue. We realized we didn't really have enough material. I mean, I watched a lot of videos on like meetings that were using the Delphi technique to try and build this public consensus. A lot of them were like 10 years old and they were in California. It didn't really translate to good pod. So I proposed this. I'd been sitting on this article we're going to talk about for a long time. It's not a new article, but the timing of it is certainly very interesting. It came out in February 2021. So we're a little bit like a month past January 6th. There is, one could argue, a disputed election or a lot of curiosity about what has happened in the last election. We see the inauguration of a new president, friendly or more friendly to the publication. Sorry, go ahead.
That's so funny. You said, you know, one could argue a disputed, like there's no question that it's disputed. Like nobody,
a lot of people don't
agree about what happened. You know? But see, all of this, the way these people act, like the author of this story, this article we're going to read, the way these people act cause us to not even speak in an honest way, you and I. Like, you're like, well, arguably, I'm not jumping on you, but you know what I'm saying? Like, we feel like we have to qualify things that are categorically just true.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a contentious election. Oh, gosh.
I'm going to have a hard time here.
Well, we'll have a hard time together because I know I feel like I'm maintaining some calm now. But I know once I get back into this article, I messaged you yesterday. I said we have to do this. This article is an absolute feast for the things that we cover on each of our shows. Again, you said the title. It's Don't Go Down the Rabbit Hole. The slug is critical thinking, as we're taught to do it, isn't helping in the fight against misinformation. Now, again, February, it's like right before we transition into the next round of divisive medical topics in the United States, a month into a new presidency coming out of the January 6th thing. So there's lots of things that make the timing of this op-ed interesting. I don't think we have to read into that too much. Now, this is an opinion piece, right? But to New York Times readers, and the offshoots of that, that basically means this is the section of the paper where you get your opinions. I know that from experience. So you can't just dismiss it as like, oh, it's just op-ed.
Right. So if you go look at the URL, so this is from the New York Times, as you said, newyorktimes.com/2021/02/18. There's the date. /opinion. /fake-news-media-attention.html. So this is in the opinion section. You know, it's so it's an editorial, supposedly an opinion, but it has a lot of citations in it, doesn't it? And they interview a lot of people. Like, I'm not used to seeing op-eds with citations, footnotes, and expert interviews.
Right.
It is written like a piece of their regular journalism, and they just put it in that section. You said that it's an opinion piece just now. Hell, I forgot, because it doesn't read like an opinion piece.
Not at all. That's a really good point. Yeah.
When you said that, it bumped me because I forgot that it was an opinion piece. But yes, because it doesn't read like one whatsoever.
Right. Now, it's instructional. It's instructional. It's literally giving like practical instructions for information literacy, as they will call it, bolstered by academic citation, right? And interviews with people who know what they're doing. And I mean, for God's sakes, readers, teach this stuff. But yeah, that's an escape hatch by putting it in this section. Because I mean, obviously, this is, I think these people have, you know, enough of a window outside of their bubble to know that this is going to be a very controversial article. I didn't see lots of attacks about this. You know, I've been sitting on this article for months. And I think the only thing that I even saw was like one YouTube video and a Zero Hedge article responding to it.
Good old Zero Hedge. You can always count on them.
Yeah, and I can't see I don't know what the engagement was on the New York Times. I had to find it on archive.org to see the whole article. But yeah, there wasn't a lot of discussion about this, and this article is not an isolated event, especially now in this current news week that we're in, where you know, the Biden administration is telling Facebook posts that they want removed, both directly and indirectly, and the president making statements like Facebook is killing people, death by misinformation, kind of a thing. And that's not new either. This social media where all these people have been brought into social media, and then, you know, that lever was flipped, and it is now this information control technology. I don't know if it was intended to be that from the beginning, but that's certainly what it has become. And, you know, just earlier this year, and I don't know when some of these interviews took place, but they are actually going to encourage that kind of like, go to these so-called knowledge hubs when you have questions and get answers very, very quickly from them. Right. Trusted sources.
Trusted sources.
So here's how I thought we could approach this. We could read, we could pause, maybe we only make it through the first paragraph in you know, the hour and a half that we have. That's fine, but we'll get through as much of it as we can. I'll drop the archive.org link in the show notes so people can go read the rest if they wish. You ready to get started?
I'm ready.
All right. The author is Charlie Warzel, opinion writer at large, February 18th, 2021. Our attention economy allows grifters, conspiracy theorists, trolls, and savvy attention hijackers to take advantage of us and steal our focus. I wonder if he's going to provide a criteria for identification of these labels, right? Because those are certainly terms of dismissal, And if it's just kind of taken as a given, like you're supposed to know what these things mean, and when we use these terms, picture this person without, you know, any further examination. But we'll see if a criteria is given. For an academic, Michael Caulfield has an odd request. Stop overthinking what you see online. Mr. Caulfield, a digital literacy expert, which is also not explained, at Washington State University, Vancouver, knows all too well that at this very moment, more people are fighting for the opportunity to lie to you than perhaps at any point in human history. Certainly agree with that. This last paragraph, and then we'll pause. Misinformation rides the greased algorithmic rails of powerful social media platforms and travels at velocities and in volumes that make it nearly impossible to stop. That alone makes information warfare an unfair fight for the average internet user. But Mr. Caulfield argues that the deck is stacked even further against us, that the way we're taught from a young age to evaluate and think critically about information is fundamentally flawed and out of step with the chaos of the current internet. How are you feeling so far?
It's like reading a pamphlet that some cult member is handing out at the airport. At the end of this, he says, the deck is stacked even further against us. I think it's pretty clear who us and them are, right? For the New York Times to say that the deck is stacked against them in terms of information warfare is one of the most absurd fucking assertions that they could possibly make.
I totally agree. I mean, and this is like, what do we have? Like a 40-year legacy of, what did Chomsky call them? The paper of record, or, you know, agenda-setting media. Glenn Greenwald wrote an article about this like 8 or 9 years ago. Correspondence and collusion between the New York Times and the CIA. They are a nuclear sub of information warfare.
You know, Walter Durante worked for them. I mean, you could just go on and on. You said 40 years. It's been for
Oh, my God. You're right. Yeah, that's Walter Durante was supporting Stalinism, right?
Yes. Okay, yes. He wanted to put Pulitzer Prize for lies about the Potemkin villages and other things that he claims he saw in the Soviet Union. It's never been retracted. Yeah, he was a Liverpool-born Anglo-American journalist who served as Moscow bureau chief of the New York Times for 14 years following the Bolshevik victory in the Russian Civil War. In 1932, he received a Pulitzer Prize for a series of reports about the Soviet Union, which have been almost entirely discredited as misrepresentations and lies.
Right.
Yeah, they've been doing this forever. And then this is a common tactic today, that those in power claim that they're the underdogs.
Okay, but I think there's actually a distinction between those two things, where Durante, that is a political aim, while the stuff that we've seen as far as like Operation Mockingbird since, you know, like that's more about power preservation, right? Maintaining influence, like using the government, like, hey, you know, we'll do your bidding if you help us maintain our influence. And, you know, one of the things that I kind of picked up just in what we've read so far is how useful the COVID fear template is. Because basically what he's saying here is like, look, we're dealing with like a conspiracy theory pandemic. Wait, misinformation rides.
I didn't see conspiracy theory pandemic, but I like
information
that.
Rides the greased algorithmic rails of powerful social media platforms and travels at velocities and volumes that makes it impossible to stop. Again, like what we were all told about this virus, you're powerless against it. It doesn't matter what you do. You know, fate is in the hands of the virus. And it's kind of like, it feels like a similar setup of, I mean, yeah, I don't know if the word powerless was used, but the deck is stacked even further against us. Where is the help going to come from? Is there any help for us, meaning all of us idiots and our, you know, keepers at the New York Times? Where's the help going to come from? Sorry, go ahead.
Let me pour some more coffee.
Oh, go for it. That wasn't bad. I could add a sound effect.
Again, that sentence, misinformation rides the greased algorithmic rails of powerful social media platforms and travels up, blah, blah, blah. And then he claims that they're an underdog here and that the deck is stacked against them. Now, what, in fact, do the algorithms that the social media companies do? This is not a conspiracy theory. Everybody knows that they censor. Twitter will not allow a former president of the United States to tweet. Facebook blocks entire, you know, lines of thought in links to certain websites. Everybody knows that that is happening.
Yeah, and at the top of that is Google, right? And the, I mean, yes. The Wall Street Journal did a pretty good investigation. There was actually an academic study about, not that that means everything, but and the Wall Street Journal didn't rely on that for their reporting back in November 2019. It was called How Google Interferes with Its Search Algorithms and Changes Your Results. And we could get into some of the findings of their investigation, but, you know, at the top of that heap is Google. And I think that's important to acknowledge there too. But yeah, go ahead.
So everyone knows that these powerful social media platforms are manipulating their algorithms and displaying acceptable results, right? Whatever that means. Everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. This denies that, essentially. This thing is just inversion. Almost everything the guy says isn't true. It's astounding to me. When I said it's like something like a brochure or a pamphlet you're handed by some cult member, I mean that. Like the, you know, and I tangle with some of these people that would buy this. I tangle with some of them on the internet, and it's literally like they've been in a cult. Like they can't hear certain things. If you say it, all they hear is Charlie Brown's teacher.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
They can't respond. You know, and I've been thinking about this a lot, and you sent this article. You know, we know that sometimes young runaways get picked up by a cult. And then parents will hire some former Green Berets to like kidnap them back, right?
Yeah.
And then they like have to deprogram this person, you know, lots of therapy and, you know, and look, you know, I know he was handsome and he had an acoustic guitar and liked to screw runaways, but he's not the Messiah, you know, and then they have to teach him that, you know, the cult was baloney and to, you know, reprogram him. What do you do when half of the people in the country are programmed?
We were talking about boomers before we started recording, right? And, you know, I said, I think on my last show that it's nice that both of my parents, who are certainly boomers, one more naive than the other, after having some pretty heated conversations going back to like 2005 at Sunday dinners and stuff, both my mom and my dad, you know, they were conservative all along, or, you know, not conservative, voted for Republicans, right? That doesn't necessarily mean conservative, especially if you go back to 2004, but they're asking me for my input. So I thought that was interesting. I mean, and he's got Tucker in his ear for sure, who is talk about people trying to get canceled, and who I think will this year. I think Tucker and Bill Maher from the other both sides of the spectrum, I think they're going to go this year one way or the other. Yeah. So I think that skepticism is great, but all of those people are on the way out. I think there is, while you recently uncovered that there is a preponderance of bad boomer advice out there on your Instagram, you were telling me you did some surveys. By the way, it's Scott Silverstrength, right? Is your
Silverstrength? Yeah,
yeah. _ Silverstrength. Yeah. There is a kind of rising of like interest in like, well, what the fuck is actually going on here? You know, what have we been sleeping through all these years? Where now these people who just maybe they became conservative at the time that most people, or at least became Republican at the time most people do around the age of 40, but have just done everything that they've been told, you know, believed everything that they were supposed to believe, and they're about to be declared domestic terrorists because of who they voted for, right? Or what bumper stickers they have on their car. And they're going, what the fuck is going on? So I think that's good. But yeah, they're being replaced at like almost a 2-to-1 ratio as early as elementary school with this other messaging. So, and not like even if there was that kind of worldview uprising in across a larger section of the population, I don't necessarily think that's the answer either, right? Because they're just waiting for a leader or a master, you know, in their own right. So, which we saw in 2016, right? We were joking about this on the comedy podcast I did. We went to the Butler Fair. Butler became the target of the entire liberal media in 2020 when they, at their airport, held this enormous Trump rally, right? And like 60,000 people showed up in the middle of the pandemic. You know, because they weren't there for the right cause, it was a super spreader event. And, you know, I spent some time, like maybe 4 or 5 months living in Butler, transitioning back to the Pittsburgh area. And I just fell in love with that place and those people. I'd never lived. I mean, it was kind of rural where I came from, but it was certainly in the state of New Hampshire. It was infected by the politics of all those surrounding states. So it wasn't like true rural Western Pennsylvania or maybe like what the culture is out in the Midwest. I mean, we're kind of getting towards the Midwest and you see a lot of that here. You know, this idea that like these are the people who are going to save the world, even through what might just be political, philosophical, social kind of ignorance, are going to resist. Like the shit that they're talking about on CNN and MSNBC and you know, people in the administration saying we're going to knock on doors, not those doors, right? I mean, I certainly fucking hope not, because if they knock on those doors after all of the, you know, scare stories that those people are getting and internalizing, that could create a very, like I said in the last show, a politically advantageous event for people who are interested in, you know, citizens not having guns. What was my point? Why did I bring up Butler?
Well, people are becoming more aware that reality doesn't align with the things that we've been told.
Right.
And that's why there's been this backlash about against the boomers.
Here's the point that I was making, though. All those people, this rebellious, even accidentally rebellious spirit that I've come to admire in living in that place against the backdrop of what's happened in 2021, they'll all fall in line for the right man. Right. They've proven that they will line up behind the right man, behind the right charismatic figure. And that's not super encouraging to me either.
Well, but that's how it works. That's how people work. And that's how they've always worked.
So these people are the problem, or part of the problem being addressed in this article, or they are the victims of what the article is trying to address. So I will take the next paragraph or so, and then we can talk a little more. Quote, we're taught that in order to protect ourselves from bad information, we need to deeply engage with the stuff that washes up in front of us, Mr. Caulfield told me recently. He suggested that the dominant mode of media literacy, if kids get taught any at all, I guess that would come in college, but I don't think so, is that, quote, you'll get imperfect information and then use reasoning to fix that somehow. But in reality, that strategy can completely backfire. In other words, resist the lure of rabbit holes, in part by reimagining media literacy for the internet hellscape that we occupy. So would you, or maybe perhaps Mortimer Adler, right, a PDF that you give out to people who enroll at Online Great Books, have any suggestions to deal with this supposed problem that he's laying out here?
This is crazy making. I mean, this is just crazy gaslighting shit, man. So the idea that we were taught was that you can use reasoning to parse through the information you've gotten. And I remember we used to go to this thing called Reading Lab when I was in the fourth grade.
Yeah.
And we would be given newspaper articles, and we would be asked to identify bias in newspaper articles.
Right.
When would that have been? 82, 83, something like that. We were actually taught to, you know, look for that. You know, and you have to read carefully. And you have to think about it, and then you identify the bias. He's asking us to not do that. He's saying that your reasoning can't get you out of this problem.
Yeah.
This is anti-rational. Like, this is where he goes anti-rational, where he asks you to not use your rationality and your intellect to figure out what the heck is going on. So, you know, Adler, the first book we read in our program is Mortimer Adler's book, How to Read a Book. And in that book, he says that the reason we read is so that we can come to terms with the author and be of one mind with that author and then evaluate what they've said. And you can either, you know, after the author's made all of their arguments and you've understood it fully, you know, so that you could say, make the author's points back to the author, and the author would say, yeah, that's what I said. I wish I had written it that way. Mm-hmm. So once you understand them that well, then you can evaluate it and you can say, is this true or is it not true? And if it isn't true, why? And the only reasons it cannot be true is because the arguments are illogical. The arguments are incomplete. The author didn't have information that is available to you. And that's it. And if the arguments are complete, if the arguments are logical, and the author has all of the information, then you have to agree with them. Like he has very, very strict rules for evaluating, you know, any written information that's put in front of you. And it's actually not even written information. The book is How to Read a Book, but it could also be How to Listen to People.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of time. Sometimes you have to read the book two or three or four times, or maybe spend a lifetime with it. If it's Aristotle's Metaphysics, maybe. So, you know, when you're reading an op-ed piece, maybe you can't do that, but you might be able to read it twice. And you could certainly read a paragraph or two or three times if you needed to understand the arguments and the data that the author is putting forth. And then you have to evaluate it. Is it logical? Is it complete? Et cetera. And if it is, then you have to agree. And if it's not, you don't have to agree. And in fact, you shouldn't, but you know why you don't agree. We read the great books, so we'll go read Adam Smith's The Wealth of Nations, and we'll read Marx's Capital. But yep. Both, they're in the canon, the Western canon. They both can't be right.
Right.
They both can't be right. I mean, they don't agree with each other. I mean, they do at some points, but they don't agree with each other entirely. But the point for us is not that the book is correct. The point for us is that the ideas in the book cause us to think deeply about the problems addressed in the book. So you think deeply about it, and maybe you agree with Marx, or maybe you agree with Smith, but you've thought deeply about it, and you've investigated it, and now you know more about you. You know, Smith and Marx, when read properly, make you know more about you.
You've exposed yourself to multitudes. Right.
Like That's right.
So there's this Whitman quote that you guys have used a bunch on the show. I think it's attributed to Whitman, but I've also heard something similar from Emerson, where it's like, do I contradict myself? Right. Yes. Sure. I contain multitudes. I am large. Yeah. You have to have a kind of big opening at the top of the funnel before you ultimately get down to like, this is what I choose using this criteria to inform my worldview. There's a point worth making here. I think it's kind of an obvious point. Adler wrote that book. And, you know, provided this advice decades and decades and decades and decades ago, when the barrier to entry into the conversation was much, much higher, right? And the reasons why people would want to, you know, stake their claim in the information landscape were a lot different. And I would say probably much more sincere compared to why a lot of publications exist today. So, since, I don't know, I mean, you could probably trace this back further, but I would say a significant escalation in a change to the information landscape happened in September 2001, where Americans and really people throughout the Western world were taught that their information evaluation had to happen in a perpetual crisis mode. So, yes, that's quaint to take this time and engage deeply. It's kind of like the point that the author's making, but it's like, do you really have fucking time for that anymore? Like the reader of the New York Times, like there is a there's a war on for your mind, so to speak. And what are you going to do about it? We're here to help. I do still think, you know, it would have been nice and it would have built some credibility if the author said, look, a lot of people have put a lot of thought through the ages into like information literacy and how to engage with slanted or opinionated written material in an empowered way. But none of that is like, it's just like, here's some shithead academic, but we called him an academic and he taught a course. So that will just be like the end all be all of what you need to know about what to do here. Right. And still that we haven't even gotten to that yet. We're still kind of laying out the problem.
Yeah. But, you know, it's important to read that when you read this, see, he's not going to talk to us about this. It's important to read that this is rhetoric couched in the trappings of dialectic.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So, you know, you say it'd be nice if he had made this case first and then had done this. No, that's not his purpose. His purpose here,
of course,
is to make a rhetorical argument for, frankly, not reading certain things. So what does he know about his readership? He writes for the New York Times. What does he know about them? That they are dissipated moderns, right? Mm-hmm. They're busy. They're dissipated moderns. So he knows that about his readers. And he also knows that that it's for the online opinion section. And that they are probably highly engaged in social media. In fact, the New York Times probably knows exactly what percentage of their subscribers have Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook accounts. They probably know that. He knows that his readers are harried, busy, modern folk. And he knows that they're highly engaged in social media. And he probably also knows that they're narcissistic. And they're also probably proud of the fact that they're very busy and they don't have much time.
Mm-hmm.
That's a measure of how important they are.
Yes.
So he's like, listen, no, there are all these people. Like, and so if people that are involved in social media, and I'm involved in social media, we were just talking about being on Instagram, are keenly aware of how many likes and how many eyeballs and impressions they're getting. They know that. And so his arguments in here boil down to, listen, you're too busy for this shit because you're important. And then these people, don't give these people the likes. Don't give them your eyeballs.
But he does have ideas about where your eyeballs should go.
For sure. And but the main rhetorical arguments are, you're too busy for this, and don't give them your eyes.
Right.
And then everything else is kind of subservient to that. And so the busy person who's just busy, I say they're busy being busy. I was like, yeah, I don't have time for this. This is I'm on Zero Hedge. Like, what is this? I'm going to go look at Wikipedia.
I like how the threads that kind of run through it, to your point, are like, you're too good for this, but also you're helpless against charlatans. We're here to help you because of how powerless you are against charlatans.
We're here to help.
Don't try to play their game. So it's interesting, this next paragraph. It's often counterproductive to engage directly with content from an unknown source. What is an unknown source? Are there methods to make it known? I don't know. I thought that was a curious phrase, unknown source. And people can be led astray by false information. Influenced by the research of Sam Weinberg, a professor at Stanford, and Sarah McGrew, an assistant professor at the University of Maryland, Mr. Caulfield argued that the best way to learn about a source of information is to leave it and look elsewhere, which is a hyperlink, a concept called lateral reading, a term we are familiar with. When you follow his advice and click, it takes you to an opinion piece on the Huffington Post called "To Avoid Getting Duped by Fake News, Think Like a Fact Checker," written by those academics that they mentioned. The takeaway. So take a lesson from the fact checkers. This is from that Huffington Post article like near the end. Don't let your eyes deceive you. When you land on a site offering nonpartisan information, forget about the fancy logo. Ignore the .org designation, and for heaven's sake, don't put your faith in the About page. Take a minute to open up a new tab, which people could be doing right now with both the Huffington Post and the New York Times. Better still, several. Search the organization's name along with a canny keyword like funding or credibility, and just because you ace the SAT, don't think you can outsmart the shrewdest ruses on the web, especially about subjects you don't know. One fact checker told us, hubris is the hubris is the it's like I don't mean to come across this way by laughing at that three times while trying to get through this quote, but hubris is the enemy of fact checking. Tape this to your screen. So then I will return to the New York Times op-ed. There's more stuff coming in this next paragraph that I think is worth talking about. Yeah.
So there's a chunk. So the first sentence in that paragraph that you just finished.
Yeah.
Well, from the main article that you just finished before you yucked it up over the HuffPo is, it's often counterproductive to engage directly with content from an unknown source. Okay. I understand that. I also hang out on weird places on the internet. And there's a lot of talk about face fagging. Have you heard of this? We talked about it on the show, I think.
We talked about it on the Black Pill show, where it's like being out there with your real identity, which kind of exposes you. You can people didn't hear that, so you can explain it again. But kind of it's like a vulnerability or an exposure.
Among people who think in dissident ways about popular politics, they often write under pseudonyms and are anonymous because they know that their views, like any view that's outside of the regular narrative, out of the regular mainstream, outside of the Overton window, could get them fired.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see a lot of, you know, dissident politics are written by anons, are written about by anons. You know, one of these was Mencius Moldbug. You know, for years and years there was this some people call him neo-reactionary right-wing political theorist. He went by the pen name Mencius, M-E-N-C-I-U-S, Moldbug. Well, things have kind of moved on, and his ideas aren't so radical anymore. And so now we know it's Curtis Yarvin. He's come out as Curtis Yarvin, and he writes for the Claremont Institute. You'll see him on them there sometimes. He's got a Substack that's pretty popular. But he was kind of the beginning of that, I think, where these people were writing serious political thought, but they had to do it as anons.
Yeah.
And it's even worse now. It's even worse now. The potential backlash for writing outside or thinking outside of the regular narrative is even worse now than it was when Moldbug started doing that maybe 10, 11 years ago.
Oh my goodness. Yes. Yes.
So it's no surprise that this sentence is, it is often counterproductive to engage directly with content from an unknown source, because I'm telling you, most of the dissident political thought is going to be written by anons at this point. You're not going to see any earth-shattering political, you know, writing or any earth-shattering ideas coming out of, well, even Tucker, Pat Buchanan. Define whoever you think the political opposition to the mainstream narrative is. They're probably not going to be introducing any ideas that are actually effective in today's environment. You know, I'm not sure that Buchanan has been wrong about very many things. Like, time has passed, and he doesn't look so crazy. Every passing day makes him look more right, correct, than the previous.
Yeah, yeah.
But also, his ideas are politically ineffective. Like, his ideas got us, helped get us where we are. You know, so if you look at, like, Ben Shapiro, and you're like, oh, he's the opposition. No, he's not. He's not. If he was the true opposition, you wouldn't know who he was because he couldn't use PayPal or Patreon. New York Times would never link to him, and so on.
Yeah.
You know, so the real political opposition is unknown, and they have to be. And this right here, this guy knew that. He 1,000% knew that. He 1,000% knew that there were crazy people on Substack writing interesting things. I say crazy. They're not crazy. There are people on Substack writing interesting things that could actually be politically transformative. And he says it's counterproductive to engage directly with content from an unknown source.
Right.
These people have to be unknown.
Yeah, and this is not a new development either. There were people in Congress, I forget the woman's name, very ancient, terrible woman, who was talking about what journalistic bona fides were. And, like, we can't just let everybody think they're the media. The media, everybody's seen the chart of these five companies that, you know, basically control everything in the mainstream media narrative. But this is the real media. People who have bylines and write for these so-called, you know, they write trusted content for trusted publications. And, you know, everybody else is potentially a great danger to you. So that's definitely being reiterated in a way that I think is even more consequential years later in this paragraph that we just read, in that sentence that you just pointed out.
Well, I would also like to point out before we move on.
Sure.
That the Federalist Papers were written as anons.
Yeah.
You know, there's a long, long history of this. This author knows it. His editor knew it. And they don't like that.
Right.
Like, the number one book in philosophy right now for a long, long time, for many, many months on Amazon right now. I'm going to go check this. They may have buried it. It may not be true anymore because they probably buried it. It was Bronze Age Mindset.
Yep.
Bronze Age Mindset is a really strange book. It's written, it's very, very, very popular. The author is Bronze Age Pervert.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what you think about BAP, if you go read that, you're like, this guy is smart.
Yeah, absolutely.
This guy is really smart, and while he is funny, he is drop-dead serious. But he's writing as an anon, because he has to. And these people know that. They're not having it. It's not the number one book of philosophy any longer. It is number 12 in Greek history. It is number 12 in ancient and classical Greek history, and so on. It's in the top 100 in Audible books, apparently. So you're not supposed to cite that?
Yeah. I think I was talking to you about the book Why We Drive by Matthew Crawford, and I was like, Jesus, is this guy BAP? Because the ideas that he smuggles into this book that is superficially about driving, right? And it's kind of an argument against the Musks and the automation of the world. It's a fantastic book, and I got way more out of it than I thought I would just looking at the cover. But it's a lot of, like, BAP themes put in there. But he's more clever about how he doesn't go right at it, right? He puts a lot of trust in the intellect of his reader and implies lots of things in Why We Drive. Definitely worth a look if people want another avenue for getting some of the same themes. Yeah, so to pick up, we'd left off with Mr. Caulfield argued the best way to learn about a source of information is to leave it and look elsewhere. Concept called lateral reading. Next paragraph. For instance, imagine you were to visit Stormfront. Is that website still up?
I don't know.
We don't have to imagine. I can open a VPN and try. Yeah. Hold on. Let's see.
VPN? They already know about you. Listen, you don't have to go VPN.
Yeah, but Stormfront, I mean, man. This is the first time I've ever typed this into a search. What do you get? See, I would think this... all right, so the first link is Wikipedia. Stormfront website, Stormfront Anti-Defamation League, Stormfront Southern Poverty Law Center. This isn't even Google. This is DuckDuckGo.
Yeah, I'm in DuckDuckGo, and
Stormfront has been kicked offline. Slate Magazine. So, is there some deep web version of it? I don't know. But
There is a forum at stormfront.org. There is a forum there. So there you go.
Interesting. All right. So I guess we do have to imagine. For now, we'll imagine. imagine that you were to visit Stormfront, a white supremacist message board, to try and understand racist claims in order to debunk them, because you're a responsible person.
Because you have to debunk.
And now this is a quote. Even if you see through the horrible rhetoric, at the end of the day, you gave that place, however, many minutes of your time, Mr. Caulfield said. Even with good intentions, you can run the risk of misunderstanding something because Stormfront users are way better at propaganda than you. I wonder why the CIA never approached them to help out then. You won't get less racist reading Stormfront critically, but you might be overloaded by information and overwhelmed. Our current information crisis, Mr. Caulfield argues, is an attention crisis. I do agree with that last statement.
Yeah.
Quote, the goal of disinformation is to capture attention, and critical thinking is deep attention, he wrote in 2018. People learn to think critically by focusing on something and contemplating it deeply, to follow the information's logic and inconsistencies. The natural human mindset is a liability in the attention economy. It allows grifters, conspiracy theorists, trolls, and savvy attention hijackers to take advantage of us and steal our focus. Quote, whenever you give your attention to a bad actor, you allow them to steal your attention from better treatments of an issue and give them the opportunity to warp your perspective, Mr. Caulfield wrote.
This reads like an excerpt from one of those over-the-top purple florid articles that we read in reading lab in the fourth grade to try to identify bias. I mean, it's just, it's so over the top that it's unbelievable to me that anybody would take it seriously, or that it even got published by a real paper, whatever real paper.
Well, I mean, I think if you come to it with the perspective that there are no other valid opinions besides what you'll find in this publication, I mean, that's kind of like the preset of the person reading this.
It's true.
Yeah, I often think about the intentions of a lot of things we see from like left publications online. Is this just a clickbait article, right? Is it just somebody trying to, you know, come up with X number of words to justify this headline that's going to draw a bunch of right wing or libertarian ire to it? Right? Is it any more complex than that? Should I just be that cynical? Or is it, you know, a purposeful intervention against the potentially curious or suddenly curious or all of a sudden like, geez, I just can't suppress my curiosity anymore, New York Times reader who might wander, you know, off the reservation looking information on something. So I don't know. I don't know that I agree with you. I don't think, considering who it's written for, assuming that it's not written for angry right wingers to share on Facebook and kind of like,
right.
I mean, these people, they kind of like gaslight themselves at this point. And they get like little cues. Like, I saw a bunch of rage about the door to door comment. You heard about this, right? Mm. How the press secretary said it, and then Biden repeated it. A friend of mine sent me a screenshot when it happened, and he said, this is real. And it's Psaki giving that quote, like, we're going to go door to door for the vaccine. And I said, that might be kind of real, but that's not the whole story. And to me, that just seems like a trap, right? So door to door, obviously, very triggering phrase. So everybody takes to social media or to their, you know, platform at Fox News or whatever right wing publication, and they rage and they rage and they rage about this, and they say this is tyranny, door to door. That's like what the Nazis did. And then these people, or you know, their allies at places like the New York Times can go, geez, why are all these people so hysterical? It's like we're handing out pamphlets. You know,
right.
And these people think this is like Nazi Germany. What's wrong with them? Why are they so maladjusted? It's an easy turnaround to do. And like I said, if enough of that rage builds and somebody from, you know, a state's National Guard knocks on a door in some rural place after a person has raged about this sufficiently, and that's not the only cue to rage, like we're going to go door to door, there's going to be more of them, and this is going to escalate, and something that I think could be very, very bad could happen. And, you know, for the people who planted that idea, which is, you know, the administration, that's politically advantageous. So the rage, it's like a double payoff if it turns out that way. You get all the rage, all the gaslighting, all the discrediting of these people as unstable and paranoid. And then maybe you get one of them to do something.
Yeah, I think that's the case. I don't expect to see anybody going door to door. You know, I think that was one of those trial balloons where they move the Overton window with it. But you're right. You know, they prompted a bunch of outrage out of boomers who get on Facebook. Can you imagine writing political thought on Facebook?
Not anymore. No.
No, it's crazy. That whole idea and that whole discussion is a test that lots of people failed, I think.
Yeah, that's kind of what I read it as. Not much more than that. But yeah, that was just to the point of like, what's the purpose of an article like this? And it failed if it was to generate a kind of right-wing suspicion or rage, because I didn't see a lot of that. Like I said, a video is a huge article.
I don't think that this article here is bombast. I don't think it's provocative. I think it is literally.
It's a little too complex. I hate to say, but I think it is too. It doesn't have like a real personality focus, right? It's kind of like, you know, the most basic conversation is about people. The second most basic is about events. This is about ideas. So it's not like real easy to rage on this, because you do have to kind of like dig into it a little bit.
And I think this is actually a how-to for their followers.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a real possibility. Yeah.
So at Online Great Books, we think that you should engage with thoughtful, honestly held ideas and views. Right? So we would go read Adam Smith and Karl Marx. Look, they both can't be right. And they both make great arguments. I believe, that you should engage with ideas that are supported thoughtfully and in novel ways, and then evaluate those things for yourself. I don't believe that in evaluating a quote-unquote bad idea that you're going to be harmed. Mm-hmm. But here he says, even with good intentions, you run the risk of misunderstanding something, because Stormfront users are way better at propaganda than you. You won't get less racist reading Stormfront critically, but you might be overloaded by information, overwhelmed. I think there's a good possibility that if you read Marx, that you become less Marxist.
Right.
I think there's a good possibility that you read Adam Smith and you become less capitalist. I think that you actually can learn the opposite from that is being asserted in a writing. I think you can. Yeah. And you can also be convinced too. And that's the fear here. Right. Well, the fear is that somebody would be convinced.
Exactly. So this is actually like a more sophisticated update of, I think, a game they've been playing for a long time, right? You mentioned trial balloons. We've watched this thing over the 21st century so far, where it's like, as far as their perception management is concerned, step one was like, spread and justify your dumb ideas by saying everyone's entitled to their opinion. At step two is repeat step one until you basically control all political, social, cultural narratives. And then step three is to pretend step one never existed, where no one is entitled. Anybody who has an opinion that's off the script is problematic. And I think that it's a fair criticism of the left for a long time has been like, why do you think everyone is so stupid, right? Why do you think the people that are, you know, your political base, your readership, are so stupid, where you say these are the things that need to be taught in schools, these are the things that need to be excluded, updates within the last decade include these are the people who need to be canceled, this is what needs to be censored, this is what is problematic speech. Like, people can't handle it. And that's been just like the school itself. Like, we need this system imposed on people 170 years ago because everyone's too stupid. Right. Well, after 170 years of that system, the arguments are like, well, some people can't figure out how to get ID cards. Really? Mm-hmm. Really? It's so, again, like, even in the last 10 years, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy of like, well, people couldn't handle this. Now we see an entire generation that can't handle anything. I was saying on a podcast recently, like, I got into an argument with this dude, this like far left social justice warrior dude, at a party last summer. I didn't mean to. Right. And I was kind of like defending somebody else that he was attacking. And I thought the dude was going to commit suicide right there. Might have been in his like late 20s, early 30s. I thought that was it.
Tell me more about that. He made some assertions and you said, au contraire, it's actually like this. And like the cognitive dissonance was going to rip him apart. Like, what happened? Tell us more about
that. Okay. So the scene is it's a kind of a
picture it.
A nice, friendly, really beautiful Pittsburgh neighborhood. And I was like back here. I was moving back to New Hampshire at the time. So I was here for a month, packing some things up and go to this little gathering, backyard gathering at the home of two men who were married. And one was a college professor. There's more story outside of this, but this is the part that one was a college professor, and clearly, I think one was like an adjunct professor, and they had invited a couple of their friends, and they were a couple, and the dude was like he had some kind of tech job, and we're all just kind of having this casual discussion, and then it comes up like the perpetual apology that Germans have to do for like the collective guilt of Nazism. And I said, oh, man, that's bullshit. All of a sudden, like I said something like that, something to like, I'm not in support of collective guilt.
Right.
And that was all this dude needed to hear. And he just started raging. He's like, what are you really up to? What's your real agenda? Why would you say something like that? And it kind of took off from there. And then there was another college professor there. I think he was like a photography professor. But he thought I don't know, he had never seen anyone like me, I guess, or like with the kind of views I was expressing. And he took this weird, I kind of saw it as like placating or like fetishizing interest in me, where he's like, well, aren't you a curious right. character? I mean, he was being nice, but I got the sense that he's like, well, I'm obviously smarter than this guy, but I'll use him as a form of entertainment. But he took my side against this, this SJW rage that I was encountering. And yeah, it ruined the whole night. And the dude never gave up, and he kind of retreated into a corner eventually and just sat there sulking. But it was intense. And I was like, look, man, let's try to like figure this out. Like, here's where I'm coming from. He had no interest. It's like, yeah. I was an evil person as soon as I asserted a divergent point of view.
Yeah. I've run into those people, and it's like, well, listen, collective guilt. Like, you probably had a great, great uncle that did something terrible, and you're responsible for that.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know his name.
Right.
They won't hear it at all. It's astounding. And then, anyway, we're back to boomers. We're supposed to vote harder and write a letter to the editor, right? That's how you bring about political change. When there are groups of people who, if you just say, well, I just don't believe in collective guilt 70 years later.
Right.
Whose head's split open. Like, they can't do it.
Right. Yeah. And I said, do you have some kind of like personal attachment to this issue? Did you lose family members in the Holocaust? I mean, like, I wasn't trying to psychologize him or I mean, he might have read it that way, but I was like, I really want to understand why you're so passionate about this. It's like, there was no other way to be. The passion was not for anything, it was just against me, right? For saying something problematic.
Well, no, you committed a neo-blasphemy.
Mm-hmm.
That's it, full stop.
Yeah, well, and that's the other thing, too, was the kind of intensity of it, where, you know, if I felt something getting heated, I'd be like, all right, well, you know, agree to disagree. Let's not ruin a gathering over it. We're there right. for a gathering, right? We're there for a hot dog and a lemonade, right?
Right.
Not to settle some significant social issue. This dude had a different approach. He's like, I'll blow this whole fucking thing up. I'll make everybody feel super awkward the whole time to deal with you. Well, while having no means to deal with me.
That guy went home and laid in bed and just felt so yummy because he had fought Nazis.
He didn't see his affect was not one of feeling yummy for the rest of that evening. So I don't know if he turned that around.
Mm-hmm. I promise you, that he has reauthored that in his mind, and he fought Nazis that night, and he's a hero.
That I agree with you, right? Maybe it didn't feel that way.
No one there said anything, but I spoke up, and he stood there, and then no one else said anything, but I confronted him. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You're a Nazi.
Well, all right. So we've made it through, let's see, the liability of the attention economy, right? So beware of savvy attention hijackers. And that moves us on to this. One way to combat this dynamic is to change how we teach media literacy. Internet users need to learn that our attention is a scarce commodity that is to be spent wisely. Agree.
Okay, stop right there.
Sure.
Does anybody not already know that? Left politically, right politically, moderate. Does anybody think that they don't spend enough time on the internet, that they spend enough time on the internet, that their attention isn't scarce?
I think there's a lot of people who behave like they don't know that.
Well, they may behave that way.
Yeah.
But everybody knows, like, that they carry their phone everywhere. Everybody knows that. But he's saying they need to learn that their attention is scarce. Everybody knows that.
Well, we're getting to a practical lesson here.
Every time somebody deletes a spam email, it's an admission that their attention is scarce.
Yeah.
A line like that, I mean, a reason I'm drilling down on that is that a line like that just tells me that this whole thing is just full of lies.
Right.
It's just rhetoric. Everybody knows their attention. Everybody knows their ass is overloaded. Everybody knows that.
But yeah, and this is the update. Like, I don't even know if I concluded that point from before, but when I was saying, like, we need to censor things, we need to control what's taught in school, we need to control what books people read, it's because of this, like, low faith in the average human mind. And again, maybe that's self-fulfilling, but it's been a story that the left has told, or you know, the authoritarians, the scientific managers have told for a long, long time in this country. And a lot of it seems to have come true. So now this more responsible looking version of that is this. It's like, look, the game has just changed too much on the other side. You know, it's not that you're too dumb. I mean, here you are, after all, reading the New York Times.
Right.
But it's just like you don't have the capabilities. You don't know what you're up against, which is a less talking down to kind of treatment of it than what they've done before.
Let me ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
You've said earlier that the left has treated people like they're too dumb.
Right.
Like, through all the schooling, and you've given a number of examples. Roll back the tape if you'd like, listener. They're winning. They have won.
Everything. Yep, yep.
Everything. There are no libertarian or right-leaning institutions of any size or scope that exist. None. Oh, the Cato Institute. No, shut up. It's not true. Like, everything is progressive. We hold nothing. They have won. Is it possible, Brett, that they are right about their approach towards the human, the average person, and should the libertarian or the right-leaning political operative 150 years ago have operated from that standpoint? Hey, these people need to be told what's good for them. They need to be forced to do these things like the progressives have.
Yeah, so the answer is yes. And I think the check
against
that, but that's it. What else is there left for us to do? Goodbye, everybody. It's thanks for listening to the School Sucks podcast for the last decade. Well, okay. So I would say that while I accept that, obviously one of the more influential people for me has been John Taylor Gatto, who, you know, has a lot from his historical perspective, a lot of remember when stories, or the way it used to be stories, where the idea of rugged individualism, the idea of independence, the idea of autonomy, those are not mythological. Those are things that existed and still exist in pockets of this country. And yeah, I mentioned when we were doing one of our private university meetings that you were on recently, I told you about Ernie Hancock, who has been, you know, a pretty prominent libertarian voice for a long, long time. And, you know, Ernie draws a really clear line, like, you know, just to get away from left and right, because I understand, you know, it's not that simple. And it's like, if you took political labels out of it, like you brought somebody here from an island who had the capacity to, like, think about all these things clearly but didn't understand Republican and Democrat, and you ran through, like, what George Bush did from 2001 to 2008 and said, okay, which part, based on what you now know about the properties of these parties, which one do you think he is? It doesn't really mean anything. People would say he's on the left, right? This is about control. And we've watched these people who maybe, just for the sake of political opposition 15 years ago, were railing against, in some cases, not at the New York Times, but some people on the left were actually against the Iraq War, were actually against the Patriot Act, were actually against all the things that they're for now. So Those lines don't mean it. But what Ernie, the distinction that he made for a long time was, there's some people who just want to be left alone, and there's other people who just won't leave you alone. Right. Yep. And then there are people who are just kind of in the middle, not really participating in that in any significant way at all. And they're just going to kind of blow where the wind takes them, not because they're stupid or helpless, but just because they're busy. And, you know, as we didn't learn here, attention is a scarce resource. So they don't have time for it. And people have told me that. They're like, I'm glad you have time to look into this and you get some meaning out of it, but I don't have time. And, you know, I just have to kind of that was before things. I heard that 10, 12, 15 years ago, when, you know, the information environment was far less intense and polluted than it is today. Yeah, so we're getting to this practical lesson here where in 2016, Mr. Caulfield met Mr. Weinberg, who suggested modeling
the process after the way professional fact checkers assess information. Mr. Caulfield refined the practice into four simple principles. Number one, stop. That's with whatever harmful information you're engaging with accidentally. Two, investigate the source. Three, find better coverage. And four, trace claims, quotes, and media to the original context, otherwise known as SIFT. Stop, investigate, find better coverage, trace claims. All right. Don't get too angry yet, because this next paragraph is good. Mr. Caulfield walked me through the process of using an Instagram post from Robert F. Kennedy Jr., a prominent anti-vaccine activist, there's a label, falsely alleging a link between the human papilloma virus vaccine and cancer. Quote, if this is not a claim where I have a depth of understanding, then I want to stop for a second and, before going further, just investigate the source, Mr. Caulfield said. He copied Mr. Kennedy's name in the Instagram post and popped it into Google. Quote, look how fast this is, he told me, as he counted the seconds out loud. In 15 seconds, he navigated to Wikipedia and scrolled through the introductory section of the page, highlighting with his cursor the last sentence, which reads that Mr. Kennedy is an anti-vaccine activist and a conspiracy theorist.
Yeah.
So there you go. Two ad hominem labels swallowed, and you're ready to move on. No further questions. To be continued. Well, I got-